It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The Venezuelan people have spoken and the world has heard. Their beautiful voice. They are turning the page on socialism, turning the page on dictatorship, and there will be no going back. The twilight hour of socialism has arrived in our hemisphere, and frankly, in many, many places around the world. The days of socialism and communism are numbered. I ask every member of the Maduro regime, end this nightmare of poverty, hunger, and death for your people. Let your people go.
That was the President of the United States speaking yesterday to a lot of Venezuelan refugees and also people who had come here and become citizens. And John Roberts did a report on that last night. So let's listen a little bit to it before I jump in. Let's listen.
President Trump was focused on foreign policy in a speech in Miami this afternoon, throwing his full support behind Venezuela's interim president, Juan Guaido.
The people of Venezuela are standing for freedom and democracy, and the United States of America is standing right by their side.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro continues to hang on to power. President Trump now upping the pressure on military leaders to back Guaido and allow humanitarian aid into the country. The president threatening to strip military leaders of their wealth.
You must not follow Maduro's orders to block humanitarian aid, and you must not threaten any form of violence against peaceful protesters, opposition leaders, members of the National Assembly, or President Guaido and his family.
All right, so that's a bit of the report. Again, John Roberts and Fox. You know, this has been the pattern for American foreign policy. We have, since communism took over in Russia and spread itself in its ugly fashion into Cuba and Central and South America, interceded whenever we could to deliver people from its bondage, because indeed it is bondage. One of the first times we sided with people who were being oppressed by communism was in Korea. That was the Korean War, and that was right after World War II. And can you imagine how unpopular it must have been for Truman to send soldiers into Korea to fight that war when World War II was so fresh on people's minds? We were the voice of freedom. We were literally, and not freedom to look at pornography, not freedom to, you know, behave any way we wanted to sexually. That's not what American freedom is. It's freedom to make the choices in life, freedom to choose your future, freedom to design your own life. And so we have been the voice of democracy for generations. And so North Korea, we went into Central and South America many times to try to help people in those countries down there fight back the invasion of communism. We didn't succeed in Cuba. In fact, a lot of times we got in and then we pulled out and we didn't help at all. I think Korea might even be an example of that. Hungary is an example of that. And I could go on and on about the examples, the bad examples. Vietnam was another example of that. But the motive was to free people from communism. So it's pretty refreshing, honestly, to hear the President of the United States, after Barack Obama's goal was to instate Muslim Brotherhood operatives in various countries, including Egypt, President Trump resonates with the well-founded, deep-rooted in our very the marrow of our bones, real freedom that we have tried to export and bring along people of other cultures and lands. And so, you know, that brings us to this new socialist communist movement in our country, which is gaining steam. And it is pretty, it's just pretty amazing, isn't it? Alexandria Cortez, Ocasio-Cortez is just, she's just an example of that. And she is not the only person, trust me. The old socialists have just hidden it. Bernie Sanders hasn't hidden it, but the others are in concert with this. And the Democratic Party has pretty much systematically removed most people who object to some form of socialism. It's just that there are varying, you know, passions about it in the party. But the left is really becoming the strongest voice. And I think the old guard Democrats, you know, are sort of peeling back the layers themselves. And you're seeing through some of this legislation, like the Green New Deal, we're seeing really what they have in mind for us. And it is not freedom. It is oppression. It is control. It is socialism, communism. And so George Rasley of Conservative HQ has written a really interesting article on this whole thing about Amazon. Of course, I haven't talked much about this. I can't talk about everything, but of course, Amazon is a monolithic group. I'm not a fan. I use it all the time, I confess to you, because it's so convenient. But what Amazon has done to American free markets is really distressing. The stores and production that's been destroyed. Nevertheless, they are business. They're free to do that until we rein them in some way. And they were going to go to New York City, and they were going to bring 25,000 jobs. They were going to bring in like $227 billion in tax revenue over the next 10 years for New York City. But of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her consorts jumped in, started protesting and sort of threatening, you know, 70% taxes for the wealthy. And Amazon pulled out. They said, "We, you know, maybe not." And they said squarely it was because of the politicians. You know, some are saying that it was interesting that the people in Queens and the Bronx were in favor of this because it's much needed jobs. But the people who opposed it lived in Manhattan and Brooklyn. And also, a survey found that Black and Hispanic voters supported the tax incentives and the Amazon-created jobs, but the white voters were the ones that opposed it. These are the socialists in Manhattan and Brooklyn. And, of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is not white, but she is the leader of the pack, at least in terms of media, for this movement. She was thrilled that Amazon is not going, and you know all about that. Bit of nonsense. Her lack of understanding of maybe she understands better than we think. People who join that movement are out to destroy the country. So I guess that is a big successful thing for her to destroy, at least start with the economy of New York City. And isn't that funny? Mayor de Blasio is a socialist slash, I'm not sure if he's declared communist, but he's really, really off the charts on the left. And this is going to be a problem for him too. So we'll see what happens there. By the way, a poll was done recently to see how people, American people, feel about capitalism. And you will be heartened to know that more than twice the number I'll read it this way. Some of the groups most likely have a favorable view of socialism include self-identified liberals, 50%, and Clinton voters, 43%. And under those under age 30, 36%. Capitalism buried socialism in this poll by more than 2-1. And so that's good. But of course, we have a lot of work to do because our kids, as you saw in that stat, 36% of those under age 30 support it because they don't understand it. So we have our work to do, don't we? And speaking of ridiculous things, you might have heard Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez say something about the wall. Before I even get into this, I want to say something. You know, this has to do with the wall in Berlin, Germany. And well, I should play what she said and then comment on it. It is whatever that clip is, you guys, for 6. Let's hear it.
No matter how you feel about the wall, you know, I think it's a moral abomination. I think it's like the Berlin Wall.
So the wall on the southern border is like the Berlin Wall, says Cortez. I just want to say, as quickly as I can, I wish I could spend more time on this, but I lived in Berlin, Germany. I actually was surrounded by the wall myself, because if you lived in West Germany at the time that I lived there, you were in an isolated part in East Germany, surrounded on the west curved west and north and south borders on the left half of the city by barriers, and then divided from East Berlin by that wall. Very familiar. You couldn't drive very far. You ran into the wall. We were locked in ourselves. We could get out by one highway with permission way in advance, and we had to drive straight and get to our destination through East Germany in 2 hours, or they would send people looking for us. Or we could fly out. But that was it. But we were in the free part of West Berlin. But East Berliners, you may or may not know that one morning in the late 50s or in the 50s, a wall began to be built without any kind of warning. And people had gone to work. They'd said goodbye to their families. And 24 hours later, there was a wall where people could not go back home, where they were separated from their families for a lifetime without any kind of warning. It was the most dramatic, horrible thing you can imagine, the Berlin Wall. And for the years that I lived there, people were dying to get out. They died to get over that wall and get into freedom because communism is a prison. That was a wall that put people in prison. It put them behind bars so that they could not be free, and they were imprisoned to a life of control. I remember going into East Berlin and to restaurants, and the people were silent. They couldn't talk. They wouldn't look at you. They would just have their head over their plate, and you heard just the forks clicking. Inflation was terrible. The goods and services were terrible. I could go on and on. This was communism, and this is what the wall was keeping people imprisoned in that area. For Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to talk about the southern border wall to be like the Berlin Wall is really the height of ignorance and a lack of understanding. You know, the Southern Wall is there to secure our national sovereignty and to protect people within it from criminals, gangs, cartels, drug smugglers, and other foreign adversaries. The non-criminals that are coming across are not coming because they're desperate. In spite of what they say, there may be a few, but most of them are coming for economic advancement. They want the goodies that the United States has to give. They want the free goodies. They want to find work. And so they come without permission, and they take the jobs that belong to American citizens. We then provide medical care. We give them welfare benefits. We give them access to our public schools. We give them, while robbing our own economy, our own people, and our own children, they are taking advantage, and they're really basically stealing from the American people. We are keeping out the thieves from the southern border. And could I just say that there are other places to go besides the United States? Mexico has established already, you know, they've welcomed as many of these immigrants as want to stay with work visas and jobs. They can be free. It's not a matter of freedom or safety. There are plenty of other places they can go. They are free to do what they want to do, but they are not free to come in without permission. That wall is a protection for us. It is not a cage like it was for the people of Berlin. All right, Catherine Herridge gave an update on what happened after the McCabe interview. I think we just barely have time for it, but let's listen.
Counting votes or possible votes.
The former acting FBI director told 60 Minutes the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein openly discussed how many cabinet members would support invoking the 25th Amendment to remove the president. But the FBI's former general counsel James Baker, who met contemporaneously with McCabe and FBI lawyer Lisa Page about their conversations with Rosenstein, testified the effort went further. Quote, I had the impression that the Deputy Attorney General had already discussed this with two members in the president's cabinet, and that they were on board with this concept already. On Twitter, the president responded to McCabe on 60 Minutes, quote, wow, so many lies by now disgraced acting FBI director Andrew McCabe. He and Rod Rosenstein looked like they were planning a very illegal act. McCabe and others say the president's May 2017 firing of Director James Comey left the FBI and Justice Department in turmoil amid concern that the firing was designed to desync the Russia probe and obstruct justice.
I'm going to have to interrupt, Catherine. I hate to do that, but you get the gist of it. And of course, the chaos was because they were left unguarded. Once James Comey was fired, then the coup was going to be revealed. The FBI could exist with just putting in another director. It is not usually that big a deal. All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, Congressman Chip Roy will be joining us. So don't go away. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The Ministry of Preborn meets abortion-minded women right where they are. When a young mom sees her baby on ultrasound, she's 80% more likely to keep her baby.
And I got to hear and see my baby for the first time. Hearing the heartbeat made me cry, and it was certain that I was going to keep my baby forever.
This mom chose life for her baby.
She's been such a joy. Her name even means rebirth and sort of being raised up from the ashes. I now see my daughter, and I cannot imagine my life without my happy, lovely, joyful, smart baby, and I'm so grateful.
Preborn runs and leads Christian pregnancy centers all over the country. To find out more, go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 and say baby. Your love can save a life.
This is Pause to Pray, a moment each day to pray for our country's leaders.
Today, we pray for the United States Supreme Court. Our nation's highest court interprets and makes rulings on cases concerning constitutional law. As one of the three branches of our federal government, the Supreme Court provides checks and balances that serve as the foundation of our nation. We look for wisdom and fairness from our court. Proverbs 21:15 reminds us of the importance of justice and fairness. When justice is done, it is a joy to the righteous, but terror to evildoers. Right now, with this in mind, let's pray together. Almighty God, we ask you to give wisdom and guidance to the U.S. Supreme Court as they make fair and just decisions for our country. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Pause to Pray is a service of the Presidential Prayer Team, a nonprofit, nonpartisan ministry dedicated to encouraging prayer for our nation's leaders. To learn more, go to pausetopray.org.
Fox News Commentary with Todd Starnes.
Hello, Americans. Progressive lawmakers tell a bakery to toss their cookies. That story next.
Truett McConnell University.
Hey, my name is Aaron Abbs. I am an undecided major, and I'm a freshman here at TMU. And as soon as I came here, I fell in love with the campus. Like, I knew, like, God was calling me to be here at TMU. And, you know, I couldn't get a better education than this. Like, professors who pray before class, who care about your spiritual walk with Christ. You are who you are, and they care about you.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
The city of Edmonds in Washington State is going to war with a local bakery. Ken Bellingham drew fire for selling Valentine's Day cookies emblazoned with a message, "Build the wall." It was all in good fun, but the city's diversity commission condemned Mr. Bellingham. They accused him of spreading hate and division with his cookies. Now, of course, Mr. Bellingham is free to write whatever he wishes on his pastries, thanks to the First Amendment, but the diversity commission warned that words have consequences. It's not exactly clear how or if the city of Edmonds intends on punishing the bakery, but the implication is quite clear. It's virtue signaling with a baseball bat, and the city has no right inserting itself into the business affairs of a private company. I'm Todd Starnes.
That's your Fox News commentary.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
I think the president presents a legitimate threat.
Is he anti-immigration or is he anti-illegal immigration?
Oh, he's anti-non-white immigration, is what I think.
The latest, the National Emergency Declaration.
Yeah.
What do you make of it?
Ha, ha, and ha. There isn't a national emergency on our border.
There's no crisis there. I mean, there's a crisis on the planet if you want to talk about climate change.
The national emergency is Trump.
I think we should have an open border.
An open border.
Yeah.
A lot of economists will say that, you know, if you open up the borders and then you start having a lot of social welfare, you will have an expense like you've never known.
Yeah, that's true. I'm not really concerned about it. And it's hard for me to take arguments from the right about the national debt seriously. I mean, we don't need a wall. To me, that's like $5 billion that could be spent on things that could make much more substantive change.
That was a report from Fox News this morning, and that was Rob Schmidt, who went out on the street and talked to protesters gathering all over the United States yesterday to protest the building of a wall on the southern border. And you heard them. There's no emergency, and it's not a crisis. They were laughing at that. So we're going to talk about that, but I want to introduce my next guest because he's from Texas. You know Chip Roy because we talked to him when he was campaigning for the 21st District seat for Congress to replace Lamar Smith. He won that election in the fall. But let me tell you something about Chip. He's best known to many of us as the former chief of staff for Ted Cruz. But Chip's resume is really, really very impressive. He's an attorney graduate of the University of Texas Law School. He worked for Texas Attorney General John Cornyn when he was serving in that capacity. He joined Cornyn to work on the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. He also worked with Governor Perry. He was, when Ken Paxton was elected Attorney General in Texas, he became the first Assistant Attorney General, and on it goes. But I think the point I'd like to make is that Chip brings to his position in Washington about 10, 15, maybe 100 times more expertise than most congressmen who are elected. And he is a treasure, and I'm happy to congratulate him and welcome to back to the show. Good morning, Chip, Congressman Roy. Good morning.
Sandy, it's always Chip. For my friends and people that I've known for a long time, and I appreciate it. Appreciate what you're doing on the show, and happy to join you. Thank you to your listeners.
Oh, well, we have so much to talk about. I don't even know where to begin. So I'm going to just jump right into the bill that was passed just the end of last week. What some of us call an omnibus bill. It was a huge spending bill, even though it was like only a quarter of government. And of course, the big brouhaha, and rightfully so, was that the Democrats really wrote the bill, I think, had a big hand in this, and managed to only give the president a little over $1 billion to build his wall, as opposed to the requested, whatever it was, 5-point-something. And, of course, all of the restrictions, and the bill was like 1,700 pages with a 700-page appendix, and you guys didn't even get it until Thursday a.m., at like right after midnight on Thursday. So, Congressman Roy, now that you've had a chance at least to have your staff kind of read and go over it, what do you think the most egregious parts of this bill are?
Well, I appreciate you pointing that out, and you know, it'd be hard to know where to begin, and we've got a limited time on the air, but I'll just tell you this. Problem number one is what you just pointed out. On Thursday morning, my staff and I received a 1,169-page bill, and we're expected to vote on it by Thursday night. Now, that concern fell on deaf ears among our Republican colleagues as well as the Democrat leadership. Yet, as you pulled the bill apart and started looking at it, you immediately figured out that in addition to the underlying problem that we were spending an enormous amount of money on top of our debt, including, by the way, $8 billion more than the clean CR that was proposed back in December, and without batting an eye, by the way, that when you started to look at the immigration portion of the bill, putting aside the big spending, we found that, of course, the money fell short. As you pointed out, the president's $5.7 billion was only $1.375 billion. We knew that. I didn't like it for that reason. But then you found out that there were specific areas where the fence was supposed to be built under this bill that would be in the Rio Grande Valley sector. But yet in the bill, it spelled out many areas where you are not allowed to build a fence in the Rio Grande Valley sector. Five big public lands areas that they're saying, nope, no fence, which means you might as well put a neon sign saying enter here to the cartels. And then another big area where, through consultations with local government, they'll never get it done, at least not in this fiscal year. Then there was a provision called 224, which will basically say to anybody here who's illegally present that if they can get an unaccompanied alien minor to claim them as a sponsor or potential sponsor, or even in the household of a potential sponsor, that they will be free from deportation. And it basically encourages the cartels to use children as cover for people here illegally already. I could go on and on, but each of these provisions to me were enough to vote against the bill, and there were other problems in the bill. So I was a very hard no and made my voice fairly well known and outspoken on Wednesday, as we anticipated it on Thursday, show on Thursday night, and implored the president to veto it. Now, I understand why some believe they should just take this and move forward and get on with the, you know, executive actions, but I was opposed to the bill. I don't think the president, I wish he had not signed it. But, you know, that's done now. We're going to move on and keep trying to figure out how to fight.
Yeah, so, all right. So, Chip, I want to point out, I actually had the list and I can't find it. I'm trying to find it as you're talking here, of who voted which way. I know the Freedom Caucus, which you are now a new member, I thank God for that, was, I don't know if 100%, but I'm guessing 100%, probably close to it, voted against this bill. And yet the leadership, as I remember reading, voted in lockstep in favor of this bill. You have Kevin McCarthy, you had Steve Scalise, you had, I'm sorry, I'm just blanking out, but they all voted. There were no exceptions in leadership. Is that correct?
I didn't go look through the entire vote total, but I do know that the lines fell pretty strongly. Either, you know, obviously Freedom Caucus were opposed. I think the lion's share of leadership was for it. I will say that in Texas, where we have a little bit more of a sensibility about what's happening on the border, particularly in the Rio Grande Valley, 15 of our Republican congressmen and women voted no. That's a fairly sizable block. And, you know, there were a handful, I think there were five or six, I can't remember how many of the delegation voted for it. But, you know, there were some significant blocks that voted against it. I don't know what the final tally was among Republicans versus Democrats who voted no, but, you know, it was a big block.
Yeah, it was a big block. I'm just wondering if you've thought, I am so frustrated because I can't find the numbers in front of me. I've just misplaced that piece of paper. I know that all the leadership voted for this, Chip. And I realize you guys had a substantial number of votes that were opposition. But if the leadership had pushed against this bill, could you have stopped it?
Well, you know, that's one of those questions you look at. I think this all kind of came down to what the president was going to signal or not signal. And, you know, I wish that our leadership had listened to us. Some of us went to the Rules Committee on Thursday night and testified. There were three of us, the Andy Biggs from Arizona and my friend Michael Cloud from Texas. And then our friend Warren Davidson joined us actually from Ohio. And we testified to say that we thought they should just do a 1 or 2 week continuing resolution, get back down and sit down at the table and figure out if they could pass, you know, whether it would get a little bit more money or at least get rid of that 224 provision.
Congressman, we can't hear you.
You know that.
Oh, there you are. We lost you just for a second. Can you go back just a sentence, please?
Yeah, sorry about that. I'm taking my kids to school. So, but you know, I definitely wish the president had not, you know, signed it, and I wish leadership had stood up and fought against it. But at the end of the day, now we've got to get busy figuring out how to move forward and continue the fight. Let's look at the positive. We've got some money there. We've got some effort by the administration to now go forward and continue to do what needs to be done at the border. We've now got to review that and make sure that we're comfortable with the power being used. I'm happy to talk through that a little bit. And then figure out how to support the president. Look, we're going to have another spending fight in 7 months. So let's get ready now, making clear what our priorities are. And let's make clear to leadership in the Republican Party, in the executive and legislative branches, that we're serious about, you know, this is just the beginning. We've got to get going.
Well, let's do talk about that executive order, because you are an attorney and it's not like this is your first time around the block on this. And I just want to say the president, of course, from my perspective, was forced into a corner on this. How else is he going to protect the American people? If Congress is not willing to do it, which they're not, if they're not willing, how is he going to do it? And if he has to declare a national emergency, so be it. Now, let me just say that since 1976, presidents have declared nearly 60 national emergencies. And some of them are still in place. George W. Bush and President Obama both declared multiple emergencies. So this is not that unusual. But, Chip, I want to know what you think about it.
Well, I appreciate you asking me that question. Obviously, this is a very important question. So let me start by saying this. It is important, and I know you share this, that unlike our Democrat colleagues who just rolled right over when President Obama ignored the Constitution, created a status and benefits out of whole cloth with the executive actions on DAPA and DACA, that we stand up and make sure that we believe that the power is there. So let me kind of walk through the analysis real quick, if I may.
Sure.
Number one, you know, the first threshold question is there an emergency? right? Is there an emergency? I believe there's an emergency. I believe the president has been making a very good case that there's an emergency. I believe if you look at what's happening at our southern border with 400,000 people streaming across the Rio Grande Valley, with fentanyl and heroin coming in to our country, both through the ports of entry and between, with the extent to which children are being abused, the extent to which American citizens are put at risk, both by the cartels and violent gangs and people who get through that we haven't vetted, and the drugs. When you talk about the empowerment of the gangs, if you talk about what's happening with the cartels, what's happening with the Gulf cartel that's going to make $130 million by moving people to the Rio Grande Valley, I think we've made the case that there is an emergency situation at the border. Now, when there's an emergency situation, the president has authority, not under the National Emergencies Act, but under the Constitution, the president has authority to act in the case of an emergency. The National Emergencies Act just sort of frames that from Congress's perspective on how the president can do that. And then they talk about how the president can spend money. There are a large number of statutes where the Congress has, I think, more than they should, ceded authority to the executive branch, the president, to act, to spend money, to deal with various kinds of emergencies. Now, the question then becomes, is the president responding appropriately to this emergency? And we need to look through that. One of the things that the left likes to say is, well, how can this be okay when you didn't like DAPA and DACA? Well, let me tell you, when President Obama did DAPA and DACA, right, DAPA was the first one we in Texas challenged, and I was a part of that with the Attorney General's office. The DAPA litigation, which wasn't the children, it was parents and other groups beyond the children. We challenged that in court. Now DACA is being challenged in court currently by Texas and others. When we litigated that, it was not done. The president did not do it under the National Emergencies Act or under his power to declare an emergency. The president did it in theory under prosecutorial discretion. That was bogus. It was not prosecutorial discretion. He was conferring status and benefits that he did not have the power to do. Period. End of story. We won that in the Fifth, and we won it in the Supreme Court. But what President Trump is doing, wholly different, apples and oranges, apples and asparagus even. The president is declaring a national emergency and then going through the analysis of how he uses the statutes that Congress has empowered him to have to be able to then go forward and spend money to deal with the emergency. And one last point. When you look at what the president is doing, he's first using $600 million in forfeited funds that the Treasury Department has setting aside, for which no emergency declaration is needed. Then he is using $2.5 billion in monies that are set, that are there that he can use, again, without an emergency declaration, to go build fencing to stop drug trafficking. Then there's an additional $3.5 billion that is now being used, or could be used, let me put it that way, under the emergency declaration. Hey, Chip, that is the only part that we're debating.
Yeah, let me interrupt you because we're going to run out of time here. So bottom line, the president can go ahead and order construction on that border, even though the court challenges from like 14 states have come in now and other entities. He can go ahead and start with some of that money that's not going to be coming under challenge, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, so as a Texan, do you feel, now, and also there are restrictions on the kind of border wall that can be built. It can only be what's existing. The existing structures may be a little higher. Are you concerned about that?
Well, I'm concerned about all of it and all of the challenges and the environmental challenges and all of that. I think the president needs to drive ahead with the money and the law that he has behind him on particularly those parts that I've described that aren't part of the emergency declaration, and build the kind of fencing and barriers that are necessary to stem the tide and stop the emergency.
Yeah, all right. Well, listen, we are so glad you're there, Congressman Roy, and thank God the people of the 21st District saw fit to send you to Washington, because heaven knows we have enough people that are trying to do harm to this country, and we're so grateful that you are there. And I just want people in Texas to know what a treasure they have, and they need to support you. So thank you for joining me this morning, and I hope that we can talk again soon. Thank you, sir.
Anytime, Sandy. God bless.
Okay, same to you. All right, Sandy Rios in the morning.
The iniquities of the wicked ensnare him, and he is held fast in the cords of his sin. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has decided the Senate will vote on the apocalyptic socialist Green New Deal. This is a brilliant move because it forces Democrat legislators to go on record concerning the proposal to eliminate air travel, retrofit or destroy every building in America, eviscerate the fossil fuel industry, and cure that pesky cow flatulence problem in 10 years. By now, it's obvious how insane the proposal is, but vote against it and you risk alienating the most energized component of the Democrat base, the radical regressives. The turtle is shrewd.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
What does it mean to be a man or woman of all seasons? How does this kind of life lead to a legacy that honors God? To answer these questions, Ravi Zacharias examines the life of Joseph as he shares what we can learn from his story. That's this week on Let My People Think.
Sundays at 7 p.m. Central.
Instead of filling your life with the thought of your own inadequacy, focus your attention on the adequate one who is God. And through prayer, redirect your thoughts so that as you look at him, you see not your own inadequacy, but you see the adequacy of the Savior.
Join Dr. David Jeremiah for his series, Christians Have Stress Too, next time on Turning Point.
5:30 a.m. and 7 p.m. Central on American Family Radio.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. We are quite clearly as a nation locked in a bitter cultural civil war in which one side must win and the other side must lose. A cabal of members of the Department of Justice has launched a silent coup against President Trump by attempting to remove him from office using blatant lies and falsehoods. Who is behind this assault on the president? Well, the Greek word for devil literally means slanderer or accuser. Anytime you find public officials being slandered or falsely accused, Satan is behind it. The left will continue its assault on the president until they are defeated. As God's people, we have weapons of warfare, the truth and prayer, that are powerful in God for demolishing the strongholds, the lies of Satan, and robbing them of their power. It's time to go to war in the spirit for our president.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Here's a thought experiment that may seem far-fetched, but it isn't. Would you be comfortable if a hostile power could monitor and control virtually every aspect of your life, including how and whether things work in your home, what is done with your personal communications and information, and even our country's defense? Incredible as it sounds, we may be within days of such a prospect becoming virtually certain. Communist China is poised to secure its stated goal of dominating the world's fifth generation or 5G wireless networks. The United States can still avert this potential crisis for its citizens and national security by changing the model for access to wireless spectrum from the current one that enables the Chinese 5G takeover to one that will facilitate an open access, free market approach and thwart Beijing's plans. But we must flip this model now. This is Frank Affney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning.
Could you please go on my
American
computer.
Family
I'm having
Radio.
Trouble getting on a system. Sandy Rios back with you. Hey, one thing I forgot to do yesterday that I'll do today is to thank you profoundly for your generosity with our India Partners campaign. You know, we were trying to raise money for those kids in the red light district of Mumbai. And you know what? Our goal was 14,200 days of safety for these kids at $7.08 a day. And guess what? Your generosity has provided 31,744. I mean, that's just amazing. Honestly, you amaze me every time we ask for help for something that we believe is something that's worthy of the ask. You, I know a lot of you, you know, you're not like wealthy people. You dig down, you get into your checkbook, and you send money. And it's and it goes to the thing that you are sending it to, trust me. And it's just amazing. And I know India Partners is very encouraged by your response, and so are we. So thank you. And I want to give you some other good news. I just thought this was pretty interesting, and it's a story that might not have, I don't know if this was reported or not, to be honest with you. I ran across it over the weekend when I was reading, and this is what it was. The National Prayer Breakfast took place last week, and I didn't say anything about it. I'll just leave it at that. I didn't, not because I wouldn't have, just other things choked it out. But the night before that National Prayer Breakfast, this is an account from Politico. Okay, Politico is a leftist. They probably are constrained more than others. They may be more journalistic in general. They give you a lot of information, but always know that they lean left, and so they omit some things and include others that emphasize others that tip your hat to their bias. But this is what they say. The night before last week's National Prayer Breakfast, President Donald Trump was hosting religious leaders and lawmakers for a dinner at the White House when he spotted Democratic Senator Chris Coons and pounced. Trump confronted the Delaware lawmaker who attended the event at the Prayer Breakfast's official Democratic co-chair, as the Prayer Breakfast's official Democratic co-chair, over the issue of abortion, creating a tense scene in the White House's Blue Room, according to three sources familiar with the exchange. Trump leaned over in close... Gosh, I can't read this morning. Trump leaned in close to Coons, who called himself, quote, a practicing Christian and a devout Presbyterian, end quote, and laced into the Democratic senator over controversial moves to change statewide policies on abortion that have roiled New York and Virginia politics in recent weeks. He was in his face about it, said one person familiar with the exchange. The person described Trump as extremely worked up. He saw a Democrat in the room, a Democrat who's known to be a person of faith, and he was like, why aren't you speaking out about this? That's exactly what President Trump did. And of course, then the Politico goes on to add their spin. First of all, they admit that this took place in a situation where President Trump was not, you know, it was not a video, it was not a tweet. No one really was present except these three witnesses to see him confront Senator Coons on why, if you are a practicing Christian and a devout Presbyterian, how can you not be rabidly opposed to these provisions that provide late-term abortion and abortion even upon the birth of the baby, you know, killing the baby after it's born? How can you do that? How can you do that? You say you're a practicing Christian and a devout Presbyterian. That was the exchange. And so there was really no obvious political advantage to that, but of course Politico found one. This is what they further write. That passion also conveniently dovetails with what they call a concerted recent effort to energize white evangelicals who might otherwise be turned off by the concessions Trump appears poised to make to Democrats who have refused to give his demand into his demand for $5.7 billion in wall funding. So Politico thinks that the president's passion on the issue of life, the sacredness of life within the mother's womb, is only coming about because he's trying to win evangelicals who may be turned off by the fact that he's being blocked from building his border. Sorry. All right, so then they go on and talk about that. They say it's a politically good strategy and all of this. See, everything is political in Washington, everything. They reduce everything to politics. This is what I would like if I could, I may repeat this a million times because I want you to understand that when you see people debating on these news channels, they are almost always inside the Beltway, and it's almost always, and Fox is one of the worst, about the political, the strategy. I saw Molly Hemingway actually interject on the panel on Special Report a few nights ago, and I love Molly. But she was, I don't remember who she was, but they were all making talking about the political calculations of this wall. And she said, this is not about politics. This is about the safety of the United States of America. It's about our sovereignty as a nation. Yeah, good for Molly. But that's not what you hear very much. But the point is, I wanted you to hear that the president, I think, and even Politico grudgingly conceded that he was, he is passionate about life. And they had to concede that. So I just thought that was a good report that you could probably enjoy knowing about. All right. Do you remember the name, any of you, Lara Logan? I know she's been in the press in the last 24 hours, but do you really remember her? She is an overseas correspondent for CBS News. And from all accounts, she's a highly respected reporter, and maybe we'll understand why after we talk about this. But the thing I remember Lara Logan for was that during the Obama administration, during this is in Cairo, as I recall, and this was right before, let's see, now I've got to make sure I get this correctly. It's February of 2011, so it was during all of that stirring in Cairo, which was followed by the Benghazi attacks. And it was when the media and the president of the United States at the time, Barack Obama, was trying to talk us into believing in this Arab Spring. So delightful, the Arab Spring, all of these. And the Muslims are, you know, the Islam is a peaceful religion, and they're just like us. They just, they really are passionate about their God, and but they're really a very peaceful religion. Well, Lara, of course, was in the middle of this. And while she was trying to report this, she was encircled by a number of Muslim men, and she was gang raped. And I remember this very well. It was violent. And then she went and, had a long period of recovery. It was horrible. And no one really wanted to report that, not in the mainstream news. The other outlets did, the ones that I talk about so often, Breitbart and others, reported this. But it was not a big news story that Lara Logan had been raped by an endless group from her description of Muslim men who encircled her as she was reporting on what was happening in Cairo. And so that's Lara Logan, and that's what makes this next part pretty interesting. She, and by the way, it's not just CBS, it's 60 Minutes. She's a foreign correspondent for CBS's 60 Minutes. So she did a podcast with Mike Dropp, who is a former Navy SEAL. That's not, his podcast is called Mike Dropp. His name is Mike Ritland. And several excerpts have been pulled from this. Now, keep in mind, again, that Lara is a journalist, a correspondent for CBS's 60 Minutes. That's a pretty high position in the mainstream media world. It's a very high position. And so given that, in the course of her conversation with Mike, this is what she said.
It's got nothing to do with whether I like Trump or don't like Trump, right? Or whether I believe him or don't believe in him or identify with him, don't, whatever. I don't even want to have that conversation because I approach that the same way I approach anything. I find that is not a popular way to work in the media today. Because although the media has always been, historically, always been left-leaning, we've abandoned our pretense, or at least the effort, to be objective today. The former executive editor of the New York Times has a book coming out, Jill Abramson, and she says we would do, I don't know, dozens of stories about Trump every single day, and every single one of them was negative. She said, we have become the anti-Trump paper of record. Well, that's not our job. That's a political position. That means we've become political activists, in a sense, and some could argue propagandists, right? Mm-hmm. And there's some merit to that.
I wanted you to hear her say that because you hear me say that every day. But Lara's in the middle of this, and she, you know, her paycheck comes from a huge entity that is one of the purveyors of propaganda. Remember, it was CBS 60 Minutes that did the interview with Andrew McCabe just a few nights ago with Scott Pelley, who is just smarmy, as I've said before, slimy smarmy, who tries to, they color everything. They don't tell the truth. They emphasize some things and leave other things out. She would know about this, but she's the one telling you, not me. I want to read you a few other things that she said. I want to spend a little time on this. She said to him, to Mike, how do you know you're being lied to? How do you know you're being manipulated? How do you know there's something not right with the coverage? When they simplify it all, and there's no gray, it's all one way. Well, life isn't like that. If it doesn't match real life, it's probably not. Something's wrong. For example, all the coverage on Trump all the time is negative. That's a distortion of the way things go in real life. And this is the point I've often made too, that I want to repeat, is that truth, now she's talking about reporting and news, but in general, the broader perspective is all truth. Truth is what comports to real life with what you're seeing. When you hear things that sound bizarre or you see things before your eyes that sound bizarre and don't comport with truth, then it's false. It's just not true. It has to resonate with you. It has to be what you're actually seeing. It's like I gave that sort of a frivolous example, and that's of Melania Trump. She's not beautiful. She's not fashionable. She has horrible taste. Really? Do your eyes not tell you that that's a lie? That's not true? It does not comport with reality. But Lara goes on. I want to read to you some other things that she had to say. Now, she said a little bit of this in that clip, but I want to repeat it. She said, although the media has historically always been left-leaning, we've abandoned our pretense, or at least the effort, to be objective today. We've become political activists, and some could argue propagandists. And that's what I tell you all the time. You are being propagandized. You are being lied to. You are being manipulated by the press. You can't let it happen. I think most people, most reasonable people paying attention have finally figured that out, but there's a whole vast group of Americans who have just been clueless. They've been having fun living their free American lives, and they don't yet know that the little sound bites they pick up and that they echo as the echo chamber with their neighbors, just repeating a sound clip here and there. You know, what was the one during the Bush administration? Bush lied, people died. You know, they pick up these little sound bites, and the left is very good at them, and immediately think that that's true. And that's their knowledge of information and news. These are propaganda sound bites, and they do not reflect what's actually true. And then she goes on to say, this is the problem that I have. There's one Fox, and there's many, many, many more organizations on the left. The problem is the weight of all these organizations on one side of the political spectrum. When you turn on your computer, or you walk past the TV, or you see a newspaper headline in the grocery store, if they're all saying the same thing, the weight of that convinces you that it's true. You don't question it. It's because everyone's saying it. Unless you seek out Breitbart on your computer, you're probably not even going to know what the other side is saying. She said, we don't even question if what we see on social media is real or not. We don't even question if a grassroots movement is really grassroots. You know, there's a way to start a grassroots movement. You write an algorithm. You create all this outrage, and you're basically throwing out all the sparks that light the fire. So then it becomes a grassroots movement because it takes nothing to set that in motion. But did it really begin as one? And if it didn't begin that way, but was manipulated and paid for by someone and serves someone's political purpose, is it really what we believe it is? You know, that's what happened with Justice Moore in Alabama. That Birmingham Project went down and worked through social media to create what they thought was grassroots, when in fact it was fake. And they got people all stirred up, and they lied about Judge Moore, and they beat him in the election. They lied to targeted groups, but I don't want to get off on the sidebar on that. But we did a show on that last Friday. If you haven't heard it, you should listen to that. So Lara Logan did a fascinating interview. You can get that just about anywhere. I'm not going to put that on our Facebook page. But there was another part I was going to tell you about. Just so you know, there was a survey in 2014 by MRC that found that four times more journalists were self-identified Democrats than Republicans. Bernie Goldberg, who used to be with CBS, insisted that 85% of journalists voted for Obama, and on we could go. But that just gives you a perspective, and Lara's done us a great service. She says she's putting her career in danger by doing this. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.